This week on Vox Talks, the economic pandemic caused by the coronavirus. Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. We all know about the devastating health consequences of COVID-19. The disease caused by the coronavirus that has spread rapidly around the globe in a matter of weeks. But how big are COVID-19's economic consequences? The global economy is already showing signs of sickness, and so that's the theme of a new Vox EU ebook, with contributions from many of the world's most experienced policymakers with expertise in this area. And as you will hear, the prognosis is not good. On the day the ebook launched, I took part in a webinar with its editors, Beatrice Veda Di Mauro, the president of the Centre for Economic Policy Research, and Richard Baldwin, the founder and editor-in-chief of VoxEU. And in a special Vox Talk this week, we bring you an edited and condensed version of their comments from that webinar. I began by asking Beatrice whether the economic impact is more profound than a short-term hit to the stock market.
We definitely would say that the economic impact is much bigger. The stock market has somewhat belatedly realized that this coronavirus actually has much more impact than just the China shock or Asia shock. But now it is really hitting the world. And the realization that this is a demand and supply shock of a different kind than what has been seen in the past.
And Richard, we've seen a lot of pandemics in the 20th century, quite a few in the 21st century as well. But what does epidemiology tell us about how the progress of this seems to be something different?
Really, there's two things. On the medical side, it's about 10 times larger than the last big one we saw, which was SARS 10 years ago. And economically, it's really important that it's hitting the largest economies in the world. The previous epidemics, like say the bird flu or the century SARS, MERS, for example, they tended to hit either only one big economy or a few small economies. So economically, it wasn't very important. If you look at the list of the 10 hardest hit countries in terms of deaths and cases, it's almost identical to the 10 largest countries in the world. And as a consequence, the economic impact of this crisis is likely to be vastly larger than those earlier pandemics.
Now, Richard, we're going to stick with you for a minute when we look at some of the focuses of where this is going to affect the global economy. Beatrice, feel free to chime in on this. And first of all, let's have a look at manufacturing and the supply chain. You've described in the ebook that this virus is a triple hit on manufacturing. Why did you say that?
Pandemics are always a supply side effect and a demand side effect. And with manufacturing, the main supply side effect is that there are a lot of factory closures. Companies are shutting down their factory closures. There can be travel warnings, quarantines, et cetera. And unlike services, you can't run a factory remotely. So you can't tell the workers to work from home. If they don't go to the factory, nothing gets made. So that's the first direct hit, factory closures more or less. This is amplified by the global value chain nature. Firms in manufacturing source from around the world. So this supply chain linkage essentially creates a chain of contagion. And this is especially important since China, Japan, Korea, and Taiwan are heavily hit. That's the core of Factory Asia, who makes the parts that go into the factory of the rest of the world. The manufacturing shock in Asia is echoing around the world. The last thing is a demand shock. So many manufactured goods are what you might call postponable. Things like electronics, like cars. In a situation like we're facing now, lots of consumers and firms wait and see what's going to happen.
Can I maybe add some further aspects of the demand side, which have to do with the containment? because this disease is extremely transmittable. It is not extremely fatal, but the reaction to it, the public health measures in order to contain the spread, imply that you have to minimize contact between people. And, you know, economics is a lot about contact between people. Therefore, the containment measures act as a huge multiplier, at least in the short run. So the hit on the transport industry, IATA estimates, recent estimates, that the airline industry may be losing some $30 billion in lost revenues from airline travel alone.
The interesting thing about this disease is we have no 21st century tools to combat it. No vaccine, there's no cure. So the only thing we have are the 20th century tools, which is quarantines, travel bans, factory closures, and those have very important economic consequences. So although it may seem extreme to some people, this is the only thing we have to slow this thing down. And that is what's causing a lot of the economic consequences, as Beatrice said.
And the reason why we need to slow it down is that the capacities in the healthcare system are limited. If too many people arrive at the same time in the intensive care units, there will just not be enough.
Now, Richard, you analyzed the effect on international trade of the last global crisis that we had. Can you compare the impact on global trade that this one is likely to have?
It's too early to see data. The trade data is lagged by several months. But preliminary indications, especially with China, where it hit first, are that it is having a big effect on Chinese trade, although it's somewhat recovering already. So we do not know how big this will go. There's a lot of uncertainties about how big and how fast it will rise, especially in the United States, which is a little bit bigger than China in terms of production and demand. So that's a big unknown. This could be relatively short and sharp recovery of trade, but it's going to hit trade first, and it will hit trade and manufacturers above all, especially cars and electronics.
Beatrice, we've seen the oil price drop quite significantly in the last few weeks. How's that change in price going to ripple out in the global economy? Who are the winners and losers from that?
Well, we have one chapter in the book which looks at the Middle Eastern countries in particular. And of course, for all the oil producing Middle Eastern countries, this is a very negative shock. And it comes on top of the totally drying up of tourism, which is another very important source of income. It's a little positive silver lining for the airline industry that fuel costs are somewhat lower, and you know, going forward, that reduces somewhat the cost. But you know, beyond the immediate shocks like the oil shock, I think one of the important issues related to the globalization is the possibility that this shock may not be temporary. We are now thinking of this as a temporary shock because eventually the flu will either go away or we will find a way to deal with it. This state of affairs that we have right now is not going to last for the next years or two. But what may prevail is the deglobalization experience. This may become a more permanent shock than we are seeing right now. And why could this be? Well, on the one hand side, it's the experience that companies are making that all of a sudden their supply chains can be disrupted in a major way. Whether that means relocating and reshoring home, it's not clear necessarily, but it may be one of the reactions. I'm also thinking of the financial industry. I'm thinking of regulators and their stress tests. They may well in future be well advised to incorporate a pandemic scenario. What does this mean for the financial sector? What does it mean for capital requirements? That this kind of global shock will somehow be incorporated into decision makings in the future. And last but not least, also there will be a memory of how countries deal with each other and how societies deal with each other.
Does this also mean that there will be a change in attitudes to the mobility of labor and attitudes to migration in the future?
We have two chapters talking about that. One is mostly talking about Europe and about the very high costs that closures of the Schengen area would imply for the significant number of people who are working across borders. It's almost 1% of the employed people in Europe that are working in border regions or are working across borders. So shutting down Schengen would have an immediate and immense cost for them, but also, of course, for the economies that are concerned. A second contribution in the book, which is also on migration, takes a more philosophical view and asks whether the world in the future, if migration and globalization, the movement of people, is also a transmission mechanism for pandemics, and if these become much more frequent, as some people predict, whether then this would be a reason to restrict unchecked move of people in the future, at least ask this question, whether maybe the times of free movement across the globe may be over.
Richard, we have seen in the last 10 years the establishment of very, very long, very, very intricate global value chains. This is showing us, is it not, that there is also risk as well as reward for the investment that's been put in this?
As Beatrice said, I think it's likely that firms will rethink their value chains. But I would also point out that this is not new. So in 2011, the East Asian supply chain had two shocks. One, there was flooding in Thailand, which shuts down a lot of auto part factories. And there was the Fukushima earthquake in Japan, which shut down a lot of electronics parts. And so in reaction to that, firms started thinking about diversifying their supply and doing China plus one or making sure they had backup supplies. So that's already happened. And I think this will just make it continue. The trouble, though, of course, is this pandemic is hitting almost everywhere you would even possibly think of putting a factory. It's always better to not have your eggs in one basket, but there's no basket that's absolutely safe from the pandemics. And in particular, it's not at all clear that putting all the production in your own country will diversify the risk you're facing. So the reshoring, I agree with Beatrice that it's almost a knee-jerk reaction that's almost impossible to resist, but it's clearly not the right way of going about it. This virus seems to be as contagious economically as it is medically. And these value chains have a lot to do with that.
Beatrice, is the economic contagion going to affect banks as well?
It has already definitely arrived in the financial sector, and the stock market was the first to react. Bank institutions and other financial institutions are, of course, also at risk. Since the last crisis, the 10 years of re-regulation have really made capital buffers much larger in the regulated sector. But we also see that there has been a move to the non-regulated sector, the search for yield in low interest rate times. And all of this has contributed to a lot of illiquid assets and possible vulnerabilities in the non-bank financial sector. And now, of course, all of this is coming under stress. But central banks also are actually in a position to deal with that. So this is one area where I think we have much more instruments than in the medical area. The central banks as doctors have been very successful at keeping the patient's financial system alive many times.
So finally, let's have a look at the political and policy responses that can and should be made. Richard, what ammunition do governments have at the moment to offset these negative economic effects we've been talking about?
Well, let me start by taking a big run. The basic goal of the government now should be to keep the lights on. Now, that basically means keeping the cash flowing. The way our economy works is you earn income, you spend it, that creates demand, which leads to jobs, and the whole system keeps turning over. If you interrupt that, if workers who are forced to stay home do not get paid, they will not buy, and the whole thing can go out of control. Flybe is a classic example. They have lots of debt, lots of operating costs. People stopped taking the airlines. They had problems before, and they ran out of cash. So a sudden stop of cash flow can cause lots of damage in the economy. One of our authors, John Cochran, who's a professor at Chicago Booth School, he has a great analogy. He says, shutting an economy down is not like turning off a light bulb. It's like shutting down a nuclear reaction. If it's not done carefully, it can lead to big problems.
At the macro level, the classical instruments, monetary policy and fiscal policy, of the two, fiscal policy is clearly the one that should be the weapon of choice. For households and firms, there can be direct financial support. Let me give you a few examples. So in Hong Kong, for instance, a cash handout has been offered to every citizen above 18 years. So this is both, you know, a measure to help them through this time and to build confidence. Whereas in Singapore, the measures are much more targeted to the vulnerable sectors. So for instance, the whole hospitality industry, transport industry, cab drivers are receiving targeted support. So in terms of fiscal policy, there are these targeted measures that should be the first line of defense. But then it's a generalized demand problem also. So a fiscal stimulus is the next frontier, and the fiscal stimulus should be coordinated internationally and at the European level. And then moving on to monetary policy. So yes, the Fed has already moved, and few other central banks have moved with the Fed, although this has made the situation more difficult for central banks that don't have space to move rates. So the European Central Bank is sensibly thinking about possibly extending some of the non-conventional instruments that have been used in the past, in fact, in order to keep lending to smaller firms open. And these are the kind of instruments that would be useful. Monetary policy, when we are talking about effective action, it should be coordinated action. Individual action can actually cause problems of currency competition and beggar thy neighbor. And that is not what we read right now.
Let me ask you briefly both about international cooperation. The coordination in the last global crisis was one of the things that, looking back on it, were really helped to recover. And it was very important at the time, the message it sent. Politically, are we in that place where we can have global coordination now? Beatrice?
Well, the G20 certainly had its high mark in that crisis of 10 years ago, and since then has not been so successful in achieving any coordinated action. Today, clearly, as we know, the mood for international and multilateral action, the appetite is even smaller. Where I would be very hopeful is that in Europe, this may be different. In fact, the European Union has often been forceful and built in situations of crisis as like 10 years ago. But also moving beyond that, I would suggest that this is a moment where there may be the need for expanding on some of the common instruments that the European Union has. There is, for instance, a small solidarity fund, which is mostly deployed for disasters, floods and earthquakes these days. But arguably, this epidemic is very much a natural disaster. And it will also be a common shock. So there is a very strong argument for the Europeans to come together and deal with this in a common fashion.
We as economists, or we as economic policymakers, might think about coming up with common plans like the medical officials have. So the WHO in Geneva is relatively effectively coordinating all around the world. And in preparation, they have all sorts of plans and coordinations and exchanging of information, etc. So hopefully this will be an inspiration for the world to come together.
Thanks to Beatrice and Richard, and of course to all the authors of the ebook, which is a free download at foxeu.org. It's called Economics in the Time of COVID-19. Now, this is rapidly turning into a major economic shock, and this collection will tell you everything you need to know about what's happening and the likely consequences. Also, for a longer version of this interview, watch the webinar. It's got the same title. You'll also find that at FoxEU. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We're here every week, so subscribe on your podcast platform and you won't miss an episode. And there are 10 years of Vox Talks at foxeu.org/vox-talks.